Okay, we're back. And we were talking about the development of the tenure process, beefing it up.
Right, and the the achievement of tenure process now as that we created is, and as I mentioned, we're the ones that brought it to the table, is a process in which the 3 years of tenure, the teachers have the assistance of a mentor. They have contractual requirements for peer coaching training, for doing surveys and input from parents and students about their work. They do action research, they develop a portfolio, and at the end of the three-year process, they make a presentation about what they've learned about their work and about the profession to colleagues at their school site. And their colleagues then, much the same as in higher ed institutions, make a judgment about whether they are indeed ready to become a more permanent member of the profession or not. And so that we in the profession then have taken over the decision-making about whether teachers are going to become tenured or not, and not just have it be a click of the calendar or a click of the clock. Is that it used to be that if you were employed for 3 years and then came back for the fourth year, it was automatic, you were tenured. And I used to think it was really kind of disappointing that teachers would call once in a while and say, "Am I tenured?" I have no idea. Then you'd have to ask them, "Well, have you been employed, for 3 years, and were you," and so on. So it made no sense, and it was certainly not professional. And it certainly didn't mean anything, because just being a click of the clock and having you, stay under the radar and nobody went after you in the first 3 years didn't mean that it didn't symbolize that you anything. Mm-hmm. And then if your colleagues then judge that you have done the work and are okay to become tenured, then they have a celebration. And they have cake and balloons and a certificate, and the union provides that. And it's something that is that kind of celebration is a passage that we really don't have very much of in this profession. Those kinds of things are symbolic and they're important.
Right.
And so I think that has helped. We've also tried to turn the new teacher orientation into a more formal passage in introduction and induction into a really true profession. And we, in some ways, modeled it after the medical white lab coat ceremony, where interns are given their lab coat. And except, of course, we don't unfortunately have lab coats, but we give them their lanyards, so for their keys around their necks. But we have a ceremony after we do either a 2 or a 3 day induction and tell them what they need to know about the union and about the district and about what the expectations of them are. And then we have them stand and read a pledge, which is also, I think, probably unique to us. Mm-hmm. And then they come up and get their lanyard and handshake, and then they, as kind of a welcome to the Minneapolis schools, the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers, and to the profession. So we've tried to elevate not just the negative activities of what it takes to be a profession in deciding who gets to come in, how people are treated in the induction process, how they're treated throughout their career, and then making the hard decisions about who has to leave, but also doing the next level, which is the symbolic level.
How does that resonate with the younger members, the new teachers, 20-somethings, 30-somethings?
The younger members like it a lot. They like it because it's more of what they sort of expected, I think, and think is appropriate. It took a long time for the few older traditionalists to accept it, and what turned it around in most cases were the presentations that the achievement of tenure people were making to their colleagues at the school sites. Mm-hmm. And the presentations blew them away, because the experienced teachers thought, wow, I mean, this is good stuff. This is way more than I'm doing, or I ought to know some of this stuff, or this is good stuff. Because up until that time, there were experienced teachers who thought, oh, that's too much work for those people coming in the door. They right. shouldn't have to do that work. We didn't do anything. They shouldn't have to do anything. And it's when they saw what it was, they saw the results, that they really accepted it. And the new, younger ones say, look, if we are expected to be professionals, there ought to be some expectations of us.
Right.
And so they were, at least the Xers were more open to it. You want to move down there so that we get away from the traffic?
Okay. So we're just, I'm going to flip that around. You said you got the accomplishments, the new teachers getting recognized, going through the process of tenure, and getting tenure. But what happens to the teachers who are reviewed and they're not meeting up to par?
Recommendation is made to the district human resources department, and they are not renewed. Their contracts are not renewed.
So there's no second chance of, you have 1 year to shape up?
No. Because the law is pretty clear in Minnesota that it's 3 years, period.
Okay.
And there's no provision in the law for extension. It also means, however, that a person can achieve tenure under the law by just surviving the 3 years. Mm-hmm. So it just means that they can't teach in Minneapolis if they don't pass the achievement of tenure process in Minneapolis. So it is possible for somebody to spend 3 years in Minneapolis, not pass the process, and go and teach someplace else in the state.
Okay, so it's the kind of balance. You have the contract here, but they've still done the requirements for the state.
Right, and then the requirements of the state are pretty minimal. Not do anything illegal, and stay employed,
yeah.
And a couple of principals evaluations along the way.
Okay.
So then we have, had an opportunity to add let me start here. There's the AFT and the UFT, but mostly the UFT at that time, back in the mid-80s, late 80s, early 90s, had, and I think they still do, have money from the state of New York for teacher centers. Mm-hmm. And I'd heard so much about the New York teacher centers, and so we had heard a lot about, I'll stick with the teacher centers. We should go back at some point to the visits to District 2.
District 2?
Yeah.
Okay.
But the teacher center model was one that we were pretty enamored of, in that the union would train the the teachers that were selected by the site to be on-site staff developers. And then the teacher center folks would make sure that those site staff developers were continually updated and their skills were updated, and that they would continually get the new training. And so we liked that a lot. So there was an opportunity. I had some friends at the Minnesota Department of Education, and they had some money left over 1 year and they from the feds, and they didn't want to give it back.
Right.
And I said, well, we can use it. How about if you give us a grant to start some teacher centers in Minneapolis? So they did that. We got, I think it was maybe $365,000 or something. It doesn't seem like very much money now, but we made it last a lot of years. And so what we did then is make the offer to schools to if they wanted to have the opportunity to develop as a teacher center, have some on-site staff developers, on-site mentors, and start tying some of this stuff together at school sites. And so there was one high school and I think a couple middle schools and some elementary schools that became teacher centers then. And of course, it sounds like it happened overnight, but it happened over a pretty long period of time, because there again, I had somebody who was a teacher who conchoed it and led it, and it meant monthly committee meetings of people from the site, and it meant bringing principals along to being open to having this this professional activity at their school site, and to putting matching funds to take site funds to match the grant funds so that there could be site staff developers and site mentors. And those site mentors then would take over the leadership of the achievement of tenure process and the mentoring of new teachers and, in some cases, the residents. So I think at one time we probably had about maybe 12 teacher center sites. But because the eventually that money ran out and there wasn't anything else, the sites that really believed in it kept it going themselves.
Volunteer and so, type?
No, they took a site of budget money and earmarked it for keeping it going out of their own budgets without the match. So there are still a couple that are doing that. I should go back and say that in the residency program, at one time there was probably 12 or 15 residency sites also. It was always difficult. It was always more difficult to have elementary residency sites than it was high school residency sites, because high schools, you could have teachers teaching 80% of the time by teaching four classes a day instead of five.
Right.
But in an elementary site, it's you can't teach an elementary classroom 80% of the day. You got it. So it was much harder to do at the elementary. But I think we had maybe 15 at one time, and then as we stopped hiring teachers and stop the need for serious induction of teachers, it has slackened off. Mm-hmm. We have a little bill in the legislature right now to revive the residency funds and the residency language for earmarked for new persons of color. So we'll see. It's still alive, but we'll see what happens to that.
So, what was your visit to District 2?
Well, of course, we heard again around the EFT table and other places about how Alvarado and the District 2 over a decade had made more progress with kids in focusing on literacy than any place else in the country. So Tony Alvarado really was the kind of the godfather of the focusing on literacy and making it intentional and having the teacher center train all the teachers in District 2 on the same strategies, teaching strategies. He eliminated about 60% of the principals and got new principals in who believed in his strategies and agreed to follow them. He reduced the size of his District 2 central office, and he put 12% of the District 2 money into school sites for professional development for teachers, which is much closer to the, you know, the private sector investment in professional development. So he did all these wonderful things. So many of us around the country, including me, said we want to come and see so that our folks can see it in operation so they can internalize it. So three times I took teams of Minneapolis teachers, union leaders, principals, and district folks to District 2 in New York. And on all three occasions, we saw very interesting schools that looked a lot like ours, many of them, and we sort of saw what was working. I think it had an effect on what, you know, went on in Minneapolis for it never got to the point, however, in Minneapolis where Dr. Carol Johnson got close to saying, this is the way we're going to teach reading.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the way we're going to teach math. But there's this very strong, strong tradition in Minneapolis that the district doesn't tell anybody what to do, that the teachers, you know, sort of are individual entrepreneurs in their own classroom.
Right.
So it took a long time to get over that and to really realize how important it was to have teachers teaching using strategies that are proven. But that was those were important trips. I think that it also elevated the union in the eyes of the district and the principals, because in District 2 the chapter chairs at the school sites are integral to everything that goes on, and they're professional leaders, and they are in total collaboration with the school principal in leading that, you know, that professional endeavor at the school site. And those were all good lessons that I wanted people to actually see and absorb and feel.
Sure. Was this the kind of change that was going on in MFT? The members really wanted to see these things and enact these things and take it on their own roles?
Well, we were writing a lot, and I was speaking a lot. I'd go around to school sites, you know, every year talking about empowering teachers and how important it was for us to think of ourselves as professionals, to behave like professionals, to take on the responsibilities of professionals, to take on the trappings of professionals, because if we didn't do that, we had already bumped up against the sort of the highest pay scale of an auto worker, mm-hmm. or a machinist. So if you want to be a blue-collar worker, that's fine, but then we can't expect, you know, the $100,000 and over that a professional ought to be expecting. Professionals take more responsibility. And so that was kind of our message. Our message to teachers also was that, you know, they were the instructional leaders. They were the ones that knew about what worked best in classrooms, and that they ought to be collaborative with their principals. Mm-hmm. And I used Shanker's line. I can't tell you how many hundreds of times I used Shanker's line about the hospital administrator never walks into the operating theater and says, "I think you ought to cut a little to the left or cut a little surge a little more to the right." They'd get thrown out.
Right.
The role of the hospital administrator is to resource the ones who are doing the work and make sure that things run effectively, make sure that the scissors are there, and make sure that that things work well, that the support staff and everything works well. Well, of course, that's still a message. Even after, and then Dick Elmore wrote the book about District 2 and about the distributive leadership. And then we had Peter Hutchinson come and talk about his brand of leadership, of servant leadership, and all of these theories of leadership that we talked about so much were somehow just never, ever embraced by the leaders. I think we should back up just a half a second, too, and say that at the same time as all of the professionalism, and we're not, you know, done with the list on professionalism yet, but at the same time all that was happening, beginning in 1985, I believe, I started a labor management committee on benefits, because we'd end up arguing at the negotiations table about the nuances and the details of the health plan and the dental plan and this, you know. Mm-hmm. And we both the district and the union, we had some experience, or at least I had some experience with the Minnesota Coalition on Health, and we had been advised by the Minnesota Coalition on Health, and we sort of figured it out on our own that most of those conversations would be better had around a labor management committee table, and we could do all of the detail stuff at the labor management benefits committee, and then we'd bring that back, and the only thing we'd argue about at the negotiations table was how much the district was going to pay,
right,
how much the district was going to contribute towards it. So ever since 85, that committee has been in effect every month, all those years.
That eliminates so much bargaining.
Well, and it eliminates a lot of the hostility that was created at bargaining. And after that, the first couple years, it was just the teachers around that labor management. We were the only bargaining unit. Well, teachers and the educational assistants. But then the rest of the union sort of figured out that this was a good idea too, and so they wanted to expand it. And so now it includes all the bargaining units in the district.
Wow.
There used to be 22. Now I think we're down to 15. But that's where they develop the bids to go out. They're bidding the health insurance right now for the next 4 or 5 years. That's where what the benefits are going to be in the dental plans. It's a self-insured plan. What are you going to cover? And that's where a lot of things. Then at that same time, I wanted to offer a district match into the teachers' 403B or their deferred compensation account. And the state had made it illegal in the interim to offer a match to the 403B. Hmm. And so I went to a senator who was at that time considered an enemy of public employees and public employee pensions. Every employee group hated the guy. He was the brother of the Senate Majority Leader. But I went to him and I said, will you help me figure out how to do this? And so he said, yeah, I will. All I want you to do is we'll write this so that it has to be in a program that is governed by the state officers. So it has some state oversight. So we'll put it in a 457 plan, which is another kind of plan that it is indeed governed by the state constitutional officers. I said, okie dokie. So I got that little piece of legislation changed so that we could then have a district match into the deferred compensation plans. So that was kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
And it kind of happened under everybody's radar, because since nobody else would talk to the guy, I had his ear. And I've always believed in, you know, you gotta make use of who you gotta make use of.
Exactly. You brought up paraprofessionals,
mm-hmm.
and they're part of the MFT, right?
They are.
How do they fit into the equation of all this professional development? Were there any special programs for them? Career ladder steps?
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, they've done a pretty good job. It's been difficult for them in the last 5 years, as it has been teachers, because there's been some downsizing and not quite as much investment by the district in the work. But as soon as we got the peer review plan up and going, they were pretty interested in that. So I think we're, you know, one of the few ESP. What does the AFT call them now?
Paraprofessional still, or they changed that?
No, they changed it, but paraprofessional is good enough, I guess.
Yeah.
And they've gone through several iterations of names too, for paraprofessionals to educational assistants to education support professionals.
I think it's whatever Loretta wants to call them.
Right, it is. And so they thought that peer review sounded pretty good. So they have a similar peer review system as to ours. They also have a mentor program, and that was patterned after ours, that, you know, always comes a little bit later. They also have a good professional development program, in that they do collaborative professional development with educational assistants with the district.
So they are mirroring.
Yeah. And it has been beneficial to them, I think, to be in the same office, to be in the, you know, to hear the same conversations. They also, during the highly qualified time period over the last 3 years, three, four years, when educational assistants have to be highly qualified under NCLB or lose their jobs, our local educational assistance group took hold of that and developed partnerships with several higher education institutions to, first of all, get some of them needed just basic degrees, either 2-year degrees, or some of them wanted 4-year degrees. Some of them wanted to go on and get a teacher licensure, and then some of them needed basic skills. And so they had classes in our union office for a long time, helping, you know, first get the basic skills, then get the classes, then get the two-year degree, and then on from there. A lot of partnerships. One was with a Native American higher ed institution. One is with the Minneapolis Community College, and various interesting institutions. So they really took the leadership on that NCLB, helping their members get deemed highly qualified so that they could pass the test. Now they lost a few who never could quite make it, but they had they not taken that leadership, they would have lost a lot more than they did. I think that the we also could talk about the as far as our professional continuum is concerned, along the way we started following the tenets of quality management, and we called it EQM, Education Quality Management, because there was a period of time back in the 90s when we were spending a lot of time trying to mirror the private sector's focus on quality. And I always thought and still do that the public sector has missed the boat on what quality management really, really meant, because quality management, the number one tenet that's always listed is value employees. And it's the part that public sector employers most often totally miss, ignore, don't believe, don't know how, or whatever. So we spend a lot of time in working with Minnesota Council for Quality, with the Minnesota Academic Excellence Foundation, got funds from the state of Minnesota to use to reward school sites that were using educational quality management. And we did that by developing our QPA, Quality Performance Award Grants to School Sites. And the Quality Performance Award Grants to School Sites, we divided up $400,000 every other year to school sites that beat the odds, help the kids beat the odds. In order to do that, we had 33 indicators that were not just tests, and we still use them. They're still in the contract. The district still uses them. That they're, in addition to standardized test scores, we use standards-based tests, not just standardized, but standards-based. We use attendance and mobility and number of underrepresented kids in the various programs, like can you turn that off a minute?
Yeah.
Management.
Okay.
So the accounting is one of the indicators, the number of kids of color in gifted and talented programs. Mm-hmm. And anyway, there's 33 of them. And then the sites that won those award got $25 per student, and they could use that money in any way they wished. And then there was an awards ceremony in which the teachers talked about what they did to help kids beat the odds in that school. So there was a lot of learning going around it, and it was really a nice program. Legislature eventually eliminated the funding, of course, since it was such a good program.
Go again.
And And all of the quality stuff that we have in our contract is still there. We have processes for assessing everybody in the district. We have processes in the standards for assessing the effectiveness of the school district in how it serves the sites. We have standards for assessing how well the sites do, how well individual professionals do, how well the parents do at supporting their kids, and also for the kids. And it's all in there. If people would just follow it, it would really be a better world. But unfortunately, we go through these cycles in which people either think that that was somebody else's regime, or that they just kind of don't advocate or don't push that it's been done and it's in there and it's good stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's been, I think, one of the hardest things of the 25 years of leadership, is to not let people go astray and not let all of the 10 or so superintendents that I survived totally revamp what the good things, the solid things, the foundation, the scaffolding that was in that contract and that was operating in the district. And so I think for the most part we stayed pretty true to the major goals of empowering people at the sites, professionalizing teaching, focusing on student learning, focusing on growth, and not absolute standardized scores, value-added assessment, quality management. All of those were kind of major issues that we tried to keep every new leader focused on,
right,
so that they wouldn't come in and say, "Oh, here, I have the magic wand. Now we're going to forget all that and do this." So that took some articulation. It also emphasizes why in this in the AFT, because we don't have term limits, that in a lot of the urban districts, the union leader is the keeper of reform, of the reform agenda. Because in those same urban districts, the superintendents come and go and come and go and come and go and come and go. We survived them all. In our school district, the school board always hired superintendents by saying that they needed to get along and collaborate with the union. So that was helpful. It was part of their evaluation. But it was the union leader that was the voice and the face of reform that kept the focus. And I think a lot of the leaders in the AFT are in that category. It's kind of the face of urban education.
What about the NEA locals that have them, like Montgomery County and Denver? Do they have term limits in the local level?
Denver does. NEA locals that's the most successful is Columbus. They do not.
Yeah.
I think Montgomery County does. I don't know if Louisville does.
Okay, but they were managed to do some education reform and kept it going.
But in the NEA model, it's the staff people who keep it going.
Right.
Usually male staffers who have been there forever. Like in Denver, it's Bruce Dickinson, and the presidents are important, and they're the ones that articulate it, and they're the ones that are kind of front and center and take the risks. But Bruce kind of keeps the home fires burning in the.
Right.
And that's another difference.
I always forget about that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. One other area that you participated in with reform was the public strategies group.
Mm-hmm.
And was it Build Your Own School?
Well, the public strategies group was Peter Hutchinson's, is Peter Hutchinson's firm that he is the president and CEO of. And public strategies group became the superintendency in Minneapolis Public Schools. And for Peter had is a parent, was at that time a parent in the Minneapolis schools. He was also ex-finance commissioner in the for the state of Minnesota. An ex-business person in that he was a vice president, I think, of Target Corporation. And all of those, that kind of background gave him a good sense of quality management. But he then, he and his partner, Armajani, put together this organization called the Public Strategies Group, and its agenda, its corporate strategy, if you will, its identity is that it goes around the world helping public entities be really good at what they do. So they have worked in the Middle East. They've worked in other parts of the world. They've worked all over the country, and they help, for instance, state agencies. They help school districts. They help various, always public entities be efficient, focused on quality, and that's what they're about. When the school district needed somebody to restore the integrity of the financial books of the Minneapolis Public Schools, they asked Peter to come in, Peter Hutchinson to come in, and be a temporary director of finance in the school district because he had just finished his term with Rudy as the finance guy at the state. Mm-hmm. So he had credibility, and he was had credibility because he was a Minneapolis parent, and a lot of people in the city knew him. So he did that. He came in, straightened the books out, because one of those 10 or 12 superintendents I mentioned was left under a little cloud of suspicion, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And so he straightened out the books, and then they had to. They needed a new superintendent, and they were trying to figure out what to do. Carol Johnson had been an assistant superintendent for professional CNI, curriculum and instruction, but she needed to finish her PhD, so she went out to be superintendent out in St. Louis Park, which is a first-ring suburb of Minneapolis, where it was calm enough so that she could concentrate on getting her PhD done, so that the plan was to bring her back then eventually. Well, they still needed somebody to be superintendent, so one of the school board members, one of the more flamboyant school board members, and I had a glass of wine, and she loves telling this story, that over the glass of wine, she asked me about what I thought about having Peter be a private sector person, be superintendent of Minneapolis schools, what kind of accountability or plan could be given him so that he would be on the same kind of alternative salary schedule, so to speak, alternative, so that he'd be rewarded for results. So I took a napkin and I kind of outlined what it could look like to put him on a performance-based contract. So they did that. They hired Peter, put him on a performance-based contract, And he's the one that brought a lot of the quality systems and worked a lot on the systems in the school district. He put the department in the school district that did purchasing on a pay-as-you-go system, and also because they had warehouses of stuff that nobody in the schools wanted, and it just sat there, and it was inventory, and they got rid of all of that. Then he told them that he told the schools that they didn't have to purchase from the district purchasing department anymore. They could go to Staples, they could go to Target, they could go to Office Max, they could go to Office Depot. He didn't care. They could go wherever they wanted, to where they got the service and the stuff they needed. Mm-hmm. So that shaped up the purchasing department a little, because they had to be competitive then. So what the school district purchasing department did is say, we will offer next day delivery, just like all of those stores do, and we will also give you a rebate at the end of the year depending upon how much business you did with us. So that's an example of what he did with the he also eliminated some departments totally, which didn't make him, you know, popular in some, but there are only so many ways that you can cut and reorganize and really have any substantial, make a substantial difference. So he got rid of departments like the music instrument repair department and some other departments that he just totally eliminated. So he also then brought in national leaders to come and have a summit on student assessment, because we were in the middle of the assessment wars at that time. Were we going to do value-added? We were going to do standardized, standards-based, what was better? And all of these research people and all of the curriculum and instruction people were all just at each other's throats, because you had the true believers this way and the true believers that way. So he brought a bunch of experts in and had a dialogue, and I remember part of it was down at the Minneapolis Convention Center, and finally came up with a strategic direction for assessment, which the district still follows. And it sort of put to bed the assessment wars. Right. And we've had very good assessment people in the district that lead the way in value-added assessment. I also helped to somewhat help the teachers sort of understand and accept value-added assessment, that it's valuable for them, because it just shows how they take the kids where they come in the door in the fall, and then the role that they have in helping them grow and beat the odds, and it takes away all of the yah buts, and it takes away all of the adjusts for poverty, for mobility, for education of the mother, all of these things. It adjusts for all that. And so what you're left with is the actual amount that the teacher has helped that kid grow and learn. And I also wrote a little memorandum of agreement that if they were going to use value-added assessment at the school site, that the teacher and the principal would sign it so that it wouldn't be used in the evaluation of the teacher, that it would be used for, you know, growing and planning and
right.
Peter also, and public strategies group, Peter insisted that it be called the superintendency. So at the end it's got CY, and the superintendency is a team. So he brought a team with him. He didn't want to be an individual superintendent. He wanted his team to be the superintendency. So he brought some good people with him to advise in various departments. The one, again, that they did not have any influence over was leadership, particularly site leadership.
Right.
So as much as Peter did feel that he himself had some influence over some of the district leaders that he personally coached, and he's to this day is very proud of the fact that he has a personal coach, and he always meets with his personal coach, and he always said that even the best athletes in the world at the Olympics have a coach, and they, when they immediately get off the diving board or off the track, or they immediately go over to their coach and immediately look at the video, and so that they grow and get better and learn. And he said, "We all need a coach, and we all need to use that process to grow and to get better." So he was big on the coaching and mentoring. Then we got to negotiations, and he thought he was going to put his brand of performance-based pay in the contract. And I said, "Well, Peter, we already have some suggestions of our own in the, you know, in the contract discussion." But I told him that we weren't going to go with his brand of performance-based pay because it wasn't what we believed in. So he was kind of stubborn and was pretty sure of himself that it was, you know, what he had suggested was going to work. So we took it to, we went to arbitration. And we won in arbitration, so it went back to our version of performance-based pay, which we have been building on and growing and making work ever since. So he said he was quoted in the newspaper as saying that when the arbitrator's ruling came out, it felt like he was kicked in the right. Gut. And so he always says he learned a big lesson from me on being too wedded to his idea of how things ought to work.
So you helped him understand compromise.
I certainly did, yes. with a small c, after you've been ruled against, yes.
Right.
It was pretty clear to him at that point. But we had a great relationship. The one thing I feel bad is that Peter Hutchinson didn't have a couple more years in which to really institute his organizational strategies, his reorganization of the district, because what he was doing, for instance, is every department was required to survey their constituents and ask them how they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the public sector, that is not done.
It's a no-no.
It's just unbelievable. You know, you're going to ask us to do what? And so he required such departments as curriculum and instruction and professional development and human resources and all those departments to survey teachers and ask how they were doing. Well, of course, they weren't doing as well as they thought they were doing when they got the feedback back from the teachers and the principals at the school sites, which was obviously the point. Now, as I said, unfortunately, Peter wasn't around long enough to have strategies like that become embedded in the system. So when when he left, when they replaced him, a lot of those strategies went with him.
Right.
And it was too bad because he was doing good stuff. What they did is they brought Dr. Carol Johnson back kind of in the dead of night from St. Louis Park because she they were beginning to get criticism from the community that about where's the beef, where's the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And they admitted that they weren't curriculum experts. They weren't instruction experts. They were organizational experts. And so the board got nervous, and the board brought Carol back so that she could bring in the curriculum. But as happens so often, it would have been, I think, a thing of beauty had Carol and Peter and a couple of other people been able to team it.
Right.
And they tried to do that by, you know, and there's, and some places they're trying to do that by now having a chief academic officer, a chief operating officer, and a chief financial officer. But it, in some ways, it depends on who they are as to whether it works or not.
Yeah,
so
the personalities, yeah.
Yeah. But I always think that Carol and Peter would have been a good, a dynamic duo. We had lots. I've sat down one time and put the 10 or so superintendents on a bar chart, and as to how receptive, supportive, and effective they were in the reform agenda. And there were one or two that were below the line,
mm-hmm.
and there are others where that were. That shot up there, but in some ways, the worst 6 months of my career. I think it was 6 months. It wasn't much longer than that. Was when they brought back a much beloved superintendent from 18 years past, and they brought him in just prior to Peter coming on board to, again, calm down the community,
right.
Restore confidence in the of the community and the staff in, you know, leadership. But bringing somebody back from 18 years prior, to me, was about the scariest thing time period I've ever been through, because he had no clue about, first of all, relationships or collaboration or labor management cooperation or committees. And for all of the superintendents, I had always had a monthly meeting with the superintendent so that we could, you know, go over stuff. And for the months that he was there, I'd come in for this meeting because they just kept scheduling the meetings. And he never had any clue why I was there. He just couldn't sort of grasp that this was supposed to be a shared responsibility, a shared culture, and a shared conversation about, you know, what was going on in the district. Couldn't do it.
Hmm.
Instead, what he did was brought in his old henchman that was the guy from 18 years ago who was the hatchet guy.
Right.
And had it not been for all of the district folks at the central office in the district in leadership roles, they just kept working on the agenda as if they weren't there. And had that, and thank God, because we didn't lose anything then. 'Cause otherwise we would have, it would have been this giant, you know, leap backwards. But we all just kept going, kept the labor management committees meeting, kept the work going, kept the projects going, kept the, you know,
right.
Everything going. And it would, but it was the only time in my career when I lost sleep. 'Cause I just couldn't believe how fast things can be lost. Just overnight, things, you know, can change so drastically, so dramatically. So thank goodness we got through that episode without too much damage and went on. But the only other superintendent who just sort of couldn't accept the fact that the union was a part of the agenda was David Jennings, who was there also on a part-time basis. Again, the board thought they needed to bring somebody in to take care of the finances, and he had been formerly the head of the House of Representatives in